The Torah content from now through Pesach has been sponsored by the Kofsky family in loving memory of Adira, who loved big ideas and asking big questions. Hello, I'm Rabbi Matt Schneewis, and this is the Stoic Jew Podcast, where we explore the relationship between Judaism and Stoicism. We are going to continue in our plan to skip around from topic to topic in Seneca's letters, and today's reading is going to be from Seneca's letter number 86 on Scipio's villa, Scipio being a Roman general, apparently. Before I start, I want to just give you a heads up. The reading today is rather long, and my thoughts on it are rather short. And I debated, chopping down the reading into its essentials. And I thought to myself, like, well, it's you kind of get the point after a little while. Why do we have to go on and read the whole reading? But then I realized that this is one of Seneca's strengths compared to Marcus Aurelius and Epictetus. They write very concisely, but Seneca is a master of rhetoric in the sense of the art of persuasion. And one of the ways that he is so persuasive is in his use of detail and really going into vivid depictions of things. And in fact, I guess he was a playwright. I've never read any of his plays, but he was, a professional. This was his job. He was a professional writer, unlike Aurelius and Epictetus. So. And not only that, but this is really in line with the approach of Mishlei, Shlomo Melech and Mishlei, especially as explained by Sadia Gaon, that what Mishlei does is it takes ideas that are clear to the intellect but are hard for the emotions to relate to, and then by depicting them in vivid imagery and in highly particularized examples, then that's what makes it real to the emotions. And so that's my justification for reading this long excerpt from his letter. So this is not even the whole letter. I'm starting partway through and I'm ending early. So here's what he says. He's talking about Scipio's villa, okay, his house. I've inspected the house, which is constructed of hewn stone, the wall which encloses a forest, the towers also buttressed out on both sides for the purpose of defending the house, the well concealed among buildings and shrubbery, large enough to keep a whole army supplied, and the small bath buried in darkness according to the old style. For our ancestors did not think that one could have a hot bath except in darkness. It was therefore a great pleasure to me, in contrast to Scipio's ways. Sorry, it was therefore a great pleasure to me to contrast Scipio's ways with our own. Think in this tiny recess of the Terror of Carthage, that's his nickname, to whom Rome should offer thanks because she was not captured more than once, used to bathe a body wearied with work in the fields. For he was accustomed to keep himself busy and to cultivate the soil with his own hands, as the good old Romans are wont to do. Beneath this dingy roof he stood, and this floor, mean as it is, bore his weight. But who in these days could bear to bathe in such a fashion? We think ourselves poor and mean if our walls are not resplendent with large and costly mirrors, if our marbles from Alexandria are not set off by the mosaics of Numidian stone, if their borders are not faced over on all sides with difficult patterns arranged in many colors like paintings, if our vaulted ceilings are not buried in glass, if our swimming pools are not lined with Thasian marble, once a rare and wonderful sight in any temple pools into which we let down our bodies after they have been drained weak by abundant perspiration, and finally, if the water has not poured from silver spigots. I have so far been speaking of the ordinary bathing establishments. What shall I say when I come to those of the freedmen? What a vast number of statues of columns that support nothing are built for decoration merely in order to spend money, and what masses of water that fall crashing from level to level. We have become so luxurious that we will have nothing but precious stones to walk upon. In this bath of Scipio's, there are tiny chinks, you cannot call them windows, cut out of the stone wall in such a way as to admit light without weakening the fortifications. Nowadays, however, people regard baths as fit only for moths, if they have not been so arranged that they receive the sun all day long through the widest of windows, if men cannot bathe and get a coat of tan at the same time, and if they cannot look out from their bathtubs over stretches of land and sea. So it goes. The establishments which had drawn crowds and had won admiration when they were first opened are avoided and put back in the category of venerable antiques as soon as luxury has worked out some new device to her own ultimate undoing. In the early days, however, there were few baths, and they were not fitted out with any display. For why should men elaborately fit out that which costs a penny only and was invented for use, not merely for delight? The bathers of those days did not have water poured over them, nor did it always run fresh, as if from a hot spring, and they did not believe that it mattered at all how perfectly pure was the water into which they were to leave their dirt. Ye gods, what a pleasure it is to enter that dark bath, covered with a common sort of roof, knowing that therein your hero Cato, as Aedile, or Fabius Maximus, or as one of the Cornelia, has warmed the water with his own hands. For this also used to be the duty of the noblest Aediles, I don't know what that word is, to enter these palaces these places into which the populace resorted, and to demand that they be cleaned and warmed to a heat required by considerations of use and health, not the heat that men have recently made fashionable, as great as a conflagration, so much so indeed that a slave condemned for some criminal offense now ought to be bathed alive. It seems to me that nowadays there is no difference between the bath is on fire and the bath is warm. How some persons nowadays condemn Scipio as a boor because he did not let daylight into his perspiring room through wide windows, or because he did not roast in the strong sunlight and dawdle about until he could stew in the hot water. Poor fool, they say. He did not know how to live. He did not bathe in filtered water. It was often turbid and heavy, after heavy rains almost muddy, but it did not matter much to Scipio if he had to bathe that way. He went there to wash off sweat, not ointment. And how do you suppose certain persons will answer me? They will say, I don't envy Scipio. That was truly an exile's life to put up with baths like those. Friend, if you were wiser, you would know that Scipio did not bathe every day. It is stated by those who have reported to us the old-time ways of Rome that the Romans washed only their arms and legs daily, because those were the members which gathered dirt in their daily toil, and bathed all over only once a week. Here someone will retort, yes, pretty dirty fellows they evidently were. How they must have smelled. But they smelled of the camp, the farm, and heroism. Now that spick-and-span bathing establishments have been devised, men are really fouler than of yore. What says Horatius Flaccus when he wishes to describe a scoundrel, one who is notorious for his extreme luxury? He says, Bucilius smells of perfume. Show me Bucilius in these days. His smell would be the veritable goat smell. He would take the place of Gargonius, with whom Horace in the same passage contrasted him. It is nowadays not enough to use ointment unless you put on a fresh coat two or three times a day to keep it from evaporating on the body. But why should a man boast of this perfume as if it were her own? And then Seneca goes on. Okay, but I think that's enough. So what's his main point? So clearly his main point here is that times have changed, and that was once what was once viewed as normal by Scipio in terms of his bathing practices and his perfuming practices and his washing, whatever, his washing frequency, what was considered normal back then is now considered abhorrent, and only someone disgusting would do that. And now people have these high standards that they have to walk on marble and have, you know, fresh hot water and all this other stuff. And he's really saying, I mean, he doesn't say it outright, but he's really criticizing this attitude of contempt with which people look down on these old standards. Okay, so what does this have to do? Or I mean, I guess what was I thinking about when I was reading this? So I had actually just talked to my students in Lomdeja about this, and I can't even remember the context, but I guess we were talking about what types of emotions are in your control that you can work on, and which types are much more resistant to change and much more difficult. And one of the categories I isolated was there are certain things about the standard of living that we have become used to just because we live in a first world country in the 21st century and with, you know, the level of wealth that most of us enjoy. And like, you know, the notion, let's say, of, oh, I know what we're talking about. We're talking about needs, about what constitutes a need. And it is interesting how, like, things that we consider to be a need, like running water or plumbing or clean water or, you know, or other things that are much more luxurious, like air conditioning or Wi-Fi or books, you know, these are things that if you ask a person, you know, could a human being go without them? The answer is yes. A human being could go without them. You don't need them like food and water. But the thing is that psychologically, these things are so much of a pattern of like basic needs in our society that it really is hard to get out of it. And I guess the difficult thing is, you know, you look at the way that Chazal are described in the Gemara about the ones who had jobs that were like humble jobs, like water drawing and chopping wood. And I don't know what the socioeconomic status situation was back then, but they would live off of, they would work for a day and live off of that amount of money. And it's just, it's unfortunate that we don't live in a world where that's really feasible. I mean, you know, a person could do it, but like, good luck getting your family to do that. Good luck getting, if you needed any sort of prestige in the community, whether as like a leader or based on what your job is. You know, if you smelled like a goat and you only bathed once a week and only washed your arms and legs and didn't use any sort of deodorant, I mean, you just, we can't get along in a society like that. And we can't really get along in our own psyche if we try to strip ourselves of anything that is not a strictly speaking, a human need. So, I don't know exactly if I had a particular end in mind when bringing this up. It came up with my students, and truthfully, it also kind of came up in the episode a couple of days ago about how Seneca said you can't control blushing; it's just a natural response. And then I made the point that, well, you can control it in the sense that you can moderate your thoughts, and then that can affect your the way that your mind processes your blushing. Similarly here, like you can't, a person I don't think would be happy without running water and electricity. And I don't think that there's much you can do. And in fact, I think that changing the way that we relate to these luxuries that have become necessities for us is more unchangeable than dealing with your blush and your stage fright. So that is my thought for today. And if you've gained from what you've learned here today and would like to support my production of even more Torah content, please consider contributing to my Patreon at www.patreon.com/RabbiSchneeweis. Link is in the description. Thank you to my listeners for listening. And thank you to my patrons for supporting my efforts to make Torah ideas available and accessible to everyone.